To a special edition of the Midday Briefing.
I rise tonight to address two matters that are of great concern to the good folks of the 2nd District of Virginia, and I believe every American across this great land. And those two issues are these: job creation, and why is our Congress so dysfunctional?
I'm a fiscal conservative, and yet embraced in all of this, you know, I also brought my heart to Washington, my mind and my calculator and everything else. I walked out of the State of the Union and I just thought, it's like he's just completely unaware of where we're headed financially. Interest rates can only go one way. Which way? Up.
I'm so deeply troubled by where we're headed as a party. Donald Trump is not a Republican. I'm convinced of this.
I want the administration to open up here and let's gallop and create some jobs.
For the first time in my life as a voter, I'm going to have to go in that booth. I will not vote for Hillary Clinton, I assure you.
Live from the SiriusXM POTUS studios in Washington, D.C., here's your host of the Midday Briefing, Tim Farley.
On POTUS, we have a unique opportunity today, and that is to do the equivalent of an exit interview, to sit down with somebody who has been in Congress for 5 years and has decided that this is about all he wants of this, or all he can do. He is Representative Scott Ridgel. He represents the 2nd Congressional District in Virginia. He's a Republican, serves on the House Appropriations Committee, among other things, and tweets at Rep. Scott Ridgel. First, welcome to the POTUS studios again.
Tim, thank you. I've really been looking forward to this. I love the show. It's good to be here.
I do appreciate that. I was remembering today, the first time you came in the studio, it was early in the morning, not long after you had been elected, and I think after you had been sworn in, just the idea that you had about taking your business world experience, how you were going to translate that to Congress, you were going to get things done. You were part of that wave in 2010 of the Republicans. And here we sit now, and you're calling an end to the career, and you people have to ask the question, why?
Well, it's an honor to serve in the House of Representatives and serve an incredible district, Virginia's 2nd Congressional District. But I really sought the office because I wanted to, well, to put it in kind of direct terms, I wanted to take the gavel from Nancy Pelosi and hand it to a Republican. At the time, you may recall, the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and of course, the presidency. And that really concerned me, the fiscal trajectory. And one day, our new speaker, Paul Ryan, he said, you know, we've got the highest majority that we've had since 1938, I believe. And I remember I was struck by that as he said it in conference one day. And my wife and I, Terry and I, were wrestling with this question of how long should I serve? And I just had a real sense that that I was to go home, my work here was essentially done. And, you know, as part of that majority wave that came in. And Tim, I'll be the first to say, is there work to be done? Clearly, in so many areas, but it's not a health matter. I had Senator Tim Kaine, good friend. He called me and said, Scott, you okay? And I said, Tim, I'm fine. I didn't even think to mention my health. I'm in perfect health so far as I know. And it's not related to that, nor is it related to being like frustrated with Congress, although it is a frustrating place. I think there are seasons of life, and 6 years was the right number for me.
Yeah, for a lot of congressmen, it isn't. I mean, for a lot of them, they're there forever and ever and ever. And I guess you couldn't see yourself as being a career congressman.
No, I always felt that I was up here, but not of here. And I don't disparage those who I think are really into it. I mean, they may say, I hear them on the House floor. A lot of them are my friends, and they'll say, oh, Scott, this is all I've ever wanted to do all my life. And though I consider it really the highest honor outside of my family that I've ever, you know, experienced, it wasn't that for me. And it was a duty, not a burdensome one in that sense, but it was a duty-driven call that I think I tried to meet, and trying my best to, as you said, bring an outside perspective to something that's critical for our future. Which is better governance. We are failing at this, and it still has my highest attention.
I think one of the reasons I'm glad to be here with you and have you in the studio, aside from the fact that, like I said, you were here at the very beginning of your tenure, but you also come from what I would consider a swing district in a swing state.
Oh, yes, that's right.
This is not a place where you can be entirely partisan to be able to succeed, and yet that seems to be the way in politics nowadays. And let me, for people who are not familiar with you, Representative Scott Ridgel, let's go back to what inspired you to get into Congress in the first place. As I mentioned at the top, you were a successful businessman. There was no need to go to Congress. What made it so, aside from just that idea that you wanted to get Republicans back in charge, what did you want to do?
Well, I think the genesis of it, and I'm going to make this very short. It's a long, several-month journey, but I was asked to run, declined. 3 months later, I heard someone speak and said, are you concerned about the direction of your country? Are you unhappy with the direction of the Republican Party? I said yes to both of those, quietly to myself as I heard this gentleman speak. And it hit me right then that I had declined a specific ask by former Representative Thelma Drake to run. And I was hit with this wave of emotion of, what if everybody says no? What do you get there? So I had to go home and tell Terry that. I said, Terry, I need to know that I was willing. And that led to a longer process of talking to people in the district, asking them if I was the right person to run. Anyway, it became clear that I was to run, and frankly, run to win. And I ran full-time for 17 months. And Tim, the transition from a business person, a business guy, into public service, it's like immersion because, you know, immediately you find yourself,
wow.
There are video cameras in front of your face when you get out of your car trying to trick you into some odd answer to something or get you rattled.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the range of issues that a member of Congress needs to be able to be able to thoughtfully, constructively comment on and articulate a defined position on. They're really broad. So it was, I remember all the note cards that were literally on the floor as I would study before going to an event. And but I've learned so much about what's right with our country and how the things that the good people that are trying. I've also seen the causal factors, in my view, as to what are these sources of dysfunction that are limiting in a very real way the future of every American, not for one party or just one particular demographic group, but for every American.
Once again, Representative Scott Ridgel from Virginia with us as he will be finishing this term, and that will be it for him in the House of Representatives. He represents the 2nd District in Virginia. Just as an institutional matter, is the Congress of today as we sit here very different from the Congress the day you took the oath for the first time?
Well, I think if anything, it's the tension was high then. It's I think in many ways it's increased since then. And as I mentioned, and I probably as a business guy I tend to default to the solution set, but I've really given careful consideration about why are we this way? What things are causing us to kind of come off the rails as a nation? And I think it's important, you know, perspective and context on any matter is important. And I've been encouraged to a degree by reading and rereading, if you will, revisiting our American experience. And going back and reading David McCullough's books, for example, and seeing just how difficult it's been since the beginning, even prior to the Declaration of Independence. But that said, though I know it's always been difficult, though I know there's always been bitter partisanship, I can only come to the conclusion that this is different. We're in the extremis. We can get it right, but I think it's a all-hands-on-deck moment, if you will, to use a naval expression. We've got to be thoughtful about where we go from here because we can't stay on this path.
You know, I was just to that point, I was thinking and reflecting this past week on the 1960s, late 1960s, 68, for example. I grew up and I remember seeing pictures in Time and Newsweek and Life magazine, which was the big magazine at the time of the street rioting that was taking place. There was a boy in who had been shot in the streets of Newark, and he was lying there in a pool of his own blood in Life magazine. And I was thinking to myself, I kind of thought those days were behind us, you know? I was thinking, I was just a kid at the time, but I remember having an identity with this young black boy who had been shot down in the streets of Newark because of this and thinking, this is the country I live in, and I thought we had gotten beyond that. It just seems like we're not,
Tim,
fully.
That sentiment, that mindset, I think is held by many. It was held by me. I was born in 1960. I remember looking over my dad's shoulder at Walter Cronkite on a black and white television in 1967, 68, and some of the race riots then. And as I watched the decades unfold and I got older, and I remember I'd come back from a foreign trip, for example, and I'd see, you know, the American citizen line right there. And I was always so proud to go in that line because I thought, you know, we're imperfect, but we're good and getting better. And I thought that was just kind of our permanent destiny that things would just get continuously better for all Americans and to some degree. Chalk it up to naivete or something. I don't know, but that has not been the case. And there's a deep unsettledness, Tim, that I see. Look, I'm a microcosm, but as you said, Virginia too is a swing district. It beautifully looks and reflects reflects America. It's diverse. It matches about the demographic composition of our country. We're not overly poor. We're not overly wealthy. It actually has the highest concentration of men and women in uniform in the country. So it's a very special place in that sense. But this concern that we're talking about right here, and it even preceded the horrific carnage of Dallas, the things that preceded that, that's brought much of it right into, front and center. And it's on a number of things. I'm a fiscal conservative, and I'm saying as all these other things are unfolding around us, that you can't come to any other conclusion that our fiscal trajectory truly does threaten all of us.
To the point you're making about issues before, I think people ask the question, and since you're leaving this Congress and you can speak, if not with impunity, you can certainly speak honestly, not that I would expect any less of you, less from you, about what it is about even bringing up these issues. For example, every time you raise the issue or someone raises the issue of guns, we know almost exactly what's going to come out from a Republican and a Democrat. When people raise the issue of police and interaction with the African-American community, we almost know what's going to come out from each side. And there seems to be a reluctance, Social Security, some of the issues you just mentioned, a reluctance to even take a serious run at solving these issues. That's I think, the perception that Americans have.
No, that's very real. That is very real. It is oftentimes it's a red jersey, blue jersey, red for Democrats, obviously blue for D's. I was on the floor the other night. We were voting on some
red for Republicans, right? Yeah.
Yeah, red for Republicans.
Right.
And I was on the House floor the other night. We were voting on a series of amendments, and another member, fellow Republican, came up and said, "Now, where are we on this?" And the gentleman sitting next to me, who I respect and hold in high regard, he said, "Oh, this is just a skin, our jersey against their jersey. Just vote no on any Democratic amendment." And that mindset is real to some degree. And by the way, it's not just held by Republicans. Of course, it's held by our Democratic friends. And you could actually put up with some of that along the way and just chalk it up to human nature. But we cannot on these substantive issues. That's not acceptable. And
well, we always know there's posturing anyway. I mean, Ted Kennedy, when he was senator from Massachusetts, the late Senator Kennedy, was famous for getting up there and making a case and being as bombastic as he could
be. Right.
And then afterwards, he'd turn around and say, "Hey, that was pretty good, wasn't it?" And there was an understanding that there was a bit of the rhetorical game going on. There was a gambit, but it was not personal. It was not something that would prevent you from being able to work together.
Well, let me just parse that just a little bit, because I saw Sheila Jackson Lee give a big hug to Paul Ryan the other night, and I happened to be a couple of feet away. And I laughed, and I said, "Mr. Speaker," he looked, said hello. I said, "This gives me hope for my country." He laughed. They all laughed. And Sheila said, "No, I really like the speaker. We get along well. We've known each other a long time." And
well, there was quite a moment there, because Speaker Ryan and Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi had both spoken on the floor of the House Friday morning after the shooting of those Dallas
policemen. It was very moving, and I was glad to see both of them down there. So a lot of these personal relationships are strong. They exist. I don't think they're as strong as they were. I had the privilege of sitting down with Congressman Bill Whitehurst, who used to serve our district. His name is just golden in our area because of how much respect we have for Bill. He's like 91 years old, and I visited with him, and there things are different. He would tell you that they're different from what he's observed from when he served a Virginia 2nd Congressional District. Tim, I'm convinced that hyper-redistricting has hurt our country in a very real way. We're an auditory medium right now. We're not a visual one, of course. But if one could envision a bell curve about 30 years ago and 25 years ago, that would be the distribution of R's and D's in terms of their philosophical view. And it wouldn't be It was difficult, but you could get to 218 votes, which is the number needed to pass legislation. Now, the bell curve now is basically inverted. That means that the extreme sides on both sides have increased. And this is not a feeling that I have. It's not an emotion. I'm a data-driven, empirical-driven person. And I've looked at this, and I'm convinced that in part it's not the only causal factor, but that's one of them. And then second, the mobile devices that we have, they're amazing. They've allowed us to connect with our family and friends in very real ways, but we're not using them all that wisely because we've kind of bifurcated ourselves into two news streams. I noticed this. I'll make a clear example. If I go on MSNBC, and it's been a while since I've been on Rachel Maddow's show, but she's been kind enough to have me on a few times. When I go on Rachel's show, who texts me? This is very telling. It's all my Democratic friends. I'm on the way home from the studio. Scott, great job. Saw you. Well, what if I go on Fox News? Who texts me? Not my Democratic friends, all my Republican friends. And so if you channel literally, you know, the two views, and that's all you're listening to, it's hard to think that there's any good in the other side.
Maybe Republicans are afraid to mention that they watch Rachel Maddow.
That could be the case, too.
Don't want to admit they watch Fox.
Well, someone asked me on the House floor, a friend of mine, a fellow member, and she said, gosh, I'd never go on. Why would you ever go on MSNBC? And I said, well, I was an old car dealer, of course. And I said, well, that's where my customers are.
Right.
You know, I'm in the persuasion business, and I want to get to people who don't agree with me. Those are the folks I want to take a hard D, move them over, to make them a thoughtful independent,
right?
And take a thoughtful independent and make them into a fiscal conservative.
You're not going to lose a Republican by being on that show, you know, or being on in what you might consider enemy territory. You only have potential to gain someone, I would think.
I think so, but I tell you, to the point though, people are suspect, and I think there's some legitimacy in this. I remember, and I'm not trying to brag on a point here, but when the president called and said, invited me to be on Air Force One to fly down with him to Newport News, the shipyard, and we were in the middle of sequestration, I got that invitation, and I knew getting on that plane was going to be controversial. But I thought
Seen in the company of the president of the United States.
I got a call from a committee chairman as I was on the tarmac. And I mean, I could see the steps of Air Force One right there. I was 20 feet away from the steps. Call came in, Scott, my advice is don't do this. This is going to hurt you. And
was that a don't do this or you'll pay? Or was that a don't do this because I think it won't be a good idea for you? You know,
It was a friendly piece of advice. It wasn't a threat in any way. Okay. But he was concerned about me. And I thought, well, look, and I even shared this with him. I said in the vernacular of the young people, you know, if the alternative is just to do what we're doing, well, how's that working out for you?
Yeah, right. Representative Scott Ridgel with us represents the 2nd District in Virginia. He's a Republican, and this will be his last term in Congress unless for some reason he changes his mind a couple of years from now and decides that he wants to come back. I wonder how much, because it used to be that members of a delegation within their own state could make common cause on some issues. Have you been able to do that?
Oh, very much so. In fact, I'd say I almost could have set you up on that question because I think Virginia really is a model for this. We continually reference, as a Virginia delegation, it goes back to Senator John Warner. Mark Warner, our senator, would be the first.
No relation, of course.
No relation, but he would be the first to say that the model for this was John Warner. And we meet once a month, and we like each other. I mean, we genuinely like each other and enjoy each other's company. We each host one of our delegation meetings happens once a month. And so we get together, talk about things that are important to the Commonwealth, and we work together to the extent that we can. Certainly making sure that defense dollars, to the extent that they're going to be invested, we think they should be invested in Virginia. And we make that case, and we work together on a lot of things.
Yeah. I'm thinking of like Bobby Scott. I mean, his district is adjacent to yours, right?
Oh, Bobby and I are good friends. Yeah. We work together so well, and he's been good to me, and at any opportunity that I have to work with him on some judicial reform, for example, I'm with him.
Mm-hmm. It is possible then.
And oh, yes.
Maybe unlike some other states. Let's talk about when you came to town and the first impressions, you're sworn in, you know, then the freshman jitters wear off
sure.
a little bit. You set out your mind to do what, and did you get it done?
Well, the best advice that I think any member of Congress can be given, and this advice was shared with me, is look, you could go off in 100 different directions. If you really want to get something done, become an expert in it and stick to it. And I would wake up literally thinking about our fiscal trajectory. And so that's where I found my focus. Now, it doesn't mean It's done to the exclusion of other things because of our military district, strong representation for our men and women in uniform, job creation, diversifying our economy. But my principal area of expertise, one that I could debate, frankly, anyone at any time, I don't want to sound prideful there, but I mean, I feel very comfortable in this topic of where we are from a fiscal standpoint and making, actually, I think that kind of expertise is needed because you have to be able to bust through the talking points that are given by both sides that frankly lead to gridlock. If you take the Republican view of the Americans for Tax Reform pledge, not $1 of revenue increase, no matter what. You could be offered a 10-to-1 deal of expense reduction to a dollar of revenue. Not according to the Americans for Tax Reform pledge, you can't do that. Well, on the other side, we've got our Democratic friends, many of whom, over 100, have signed a similar statement on an absolute refusal to make any meaningful reforms to mandatory spending, specifically Social Security and Medicare. So with we're at loggerheads there on these issues, and you have to be able to deconstruct that and ideally bring people to some type of rational, principled alternative.
Well, who does that, though? I mean, who's the leadership that is supposed to bring that kind of conversation to bear?
Well, to some extent, it's each and every member. But then increasingly, as you've got a platform, a leadership position, a chairman position, obviously a speaker, and the minority leader, that has to be done. But it just isn't. And I respect Paul Ryan greatly. I was so pleased that he was willing it's not something he sought. I know that was the case. But I'm glad that he's willing to serve. But at the same time, there are so many competing interests, and he's got such a kind of a diverse, difficult-to-manage bunch, all of us.
It's way over 218, but he doesn't have the 218
that
he's guaranteed.
Yeah, we're 247, and we can hardly, you know, get to 218 on anything substantive. Look at the Cornyn bill that was, you know, he said basically this bill's coming to the House floor. No, it's not. Because we couldn't get 218 Republicans on the Cornyn bill for the gun violence. So
was just to take it anyone who's on the terror watch list to make it so that they could not get a weapon. And I think what was it, a 3-day notification period,
right,
or something like that.
And then I was an active supporter and introduced with Congressman Curbelo and others a bipartisan bill that matched the Collins bill, and this made so
Senator
much
Susan Collins of
Senator Susan right. Collins, and this made so much sense to me. It affects the selectee list, those who are taken out for more screening, and also the no-fly list. We're talking about literally less than 3,000 Americans. It does have provisions and substantive ones for due process. Of course, you know, I was talking to some of my colleagues about, well, you know, do you think we can get this done, all of us working together? And he said, I don't think either side's going to let this come to the floor because it would pass. I mean, there's some truth in that statement.
Say that again.
Yeah, hold on to that. Yeah, I mean that. This bill, the Collins bill, look, I'm a life member of the NRA. I have 10 firearms, one of which is one of the more notorious ones, an AR-15. And I'm a strong a proponent of the Second Amendment. That said, the statement that terrorists should not have access to firearms to me is so obvious that it doesn't even need to be defended, that statement. And as I evaluated all of these things, and my confidence that this list of less than 3,000 Americans is accurate, if we can't have confidence in our FBI to vet a list, that particular list, then we really do have issues. And so I supported this bill, and we can't get it to the House floor. We've got the Feinstein amendment basically on the Democratic side and the Cornyn language on the Republican side. But the Collins language, Senator Collins language, which we've introduced in the House, I'm convinced if brought to the House, it would pass. And this is what's very, very frustrating. Our Democratic friends are right when they say, bring these bills to the floor. I think, obviously the Collins, because I support it. I'd vote for Cornyn as well, but the Collins bill represents a real viable alternative, a principled one.
Was the sit-in by the Democrats just a political stunt? I mean, that's what Speaker Ryan called it.
Well, look, two things. I strongly object to the methodology used there. I think that there could have been other ways to elevate that issue, because, you know, it's the voluntary adherence to rules that I think represent the essence of civil government. That is, that we voluntarily are going to adhere to these rules over here. And the deliberate breaking of those rules, almost with impunity there, it seems like that to me, it hurts the institution.
Well, it makes it okay for the Republicans to do it when the Democrats get back in
charge,
too.
Well, yes, and so I that's not the right. In fact, the you know, the problem with that, here's the 180 on it, is, and the logic is of leadership and others, is we are not going to reward that behavior. Wow. Okay, I understand that. I mean, I understand the logic of that. But now we're further diminishing the chances of getting substantive legislation to the floor, like the Curbella Collins language, the one that I'm a co-sponsor. I was going to introduce it, but my friend from Florida had already, you know, kind of been working on it. I said, oh, well, I'd be happy to get on that and help him.
You mentioned before Speaker Ryan, and you worked for you were serving under Speaker John Boehner too.
Yes,
you were there for the government shutdown, the fights over raising the borrowing, the ceiling, the debt ceiling, and I wonder, just compare the two. I mean, they're obviously two very different men. John Boehner came up from practically nothing. That's not saying that Paul Ryan came up from richness. He obviously came up from lesser circumstances. But John Boehner was a guy who scrapped and he made payroll. He had to make a payroll in his business. He was a money guy for Republicans, kind of old school, heavy smoker, not a fitness nut, big golfer,
right,
kind of a country club Republican. Paul Ryan, very different, wants to be home every weekend with the kids and the family, spends every night in his office.
Very different.
So, but I mean, Was each effective? Was Speaker Boehner effective? Was Paul Ryan effective? Give us your take on this.
I think both men, and look, I think the same could be said for the minority leadership. They love our country, and they're doing their best. Now, is it enough? We could withhold judgment on each person. To Paul's credit, he is, in a very real way, made an effort, and a greater effort than his predecessor, to understand the will of the conference. I mean, we went from one conference meeting a week to two, and you can say, "Well, okay, he's had more meetings." No, no. What he's
you're a businessman, you know how that works.
Right.
Great,
but these are opportunities for members to vent a little bit. Now, what I haven't seen, and in all candor, and this isn't anything I've not said privately and to our conference generally, is that bringing forward true alternatives that have, I think, a chance of passing with some more Democratic support. Even if we didn't have 218, I'm fine at this point with putting some legislation on the table that would get passed with some Democratic support that would move us in the right direction, even a half a degree on some of these substantive matters, whether it's spending or even this effort to keep a person who is on a a no-fly list, a literal no-fly list, is less than 1,000 people. And why we can't, as fellow Americans, enact legislation that keeps that same person, we think they represent such a risk, we don't want them on a plane, but they can go in and buy a gun? This is incomprehensible to me.
Doesn't that sort of get back to the old problem you were talking about before, though, is that you have so much polarization and our redistricting in this country has meant that if you're either on the far right or the far left, you have a better chance of being reelected in a lot of the districts in the country. So now the leadership has to pay attention to them. And
absolutely,
as a result of that, the idea of the so-called Hastert rule, which isn't really a rule, but when Dennis Hastert was Speaker of the House, you wanted to be able to pass any legislation with a majority of your own conference. And now, if you can't get to 218 with just Republicans, it seems like Republicans don't want to even entertain the possibility.
That's a good working premise for people that want to understand Congress and the Republican conference right now. That premise is generally operative. I mean, there's some exceptions, but and I understand it as isn't that ideal? Absolutely, that's ideal. But if we look at our fiscal and political reality, and I do my very, very best to deal with reality, the reality is that whatever we can pass with 218 or more, virtually every time, not always, but virtually always, it's something that won't be signed into law. Mm-hmm. And we're passing it knowing that it's going to be vetoed. But it does articulate and make clear what we're for. And I think we ought to go through that process and fight for that. Fight for it. But at the end of the day, we need to understand the difference between a compromise in principle, which we've got to reject, and then a principled compromise, a principled alternative. Have the courage to reject the former and to advance the latter. I mean, this is, it's the art of that institution, the essence of that institution that is gone on substantive matters. And we're all in this together, coast to coast, Anchorage to Key West. And it's not good.
Yeah, I was just thinking of when you were bringing up that idea, the 218, about things that have happened, and you say that we vote on things that maybe have no chance of passing. You were involved in, what, over 50 votes on the repeal of Obamacare, the Affordable
Yes.
Care Act. What was your thinking as each of those votes was underway?
Well, I think early on it was important to very clearly
make
define.
A statement.
Absolutely.
Right.
It did get to be to where it was so redundant and so inefficient that I didn't understand the purpose of it. And let me say, on any type of medium, whether media that I'm here or television or in print, I am part of the Republican Conference. I'm proud of my colleagues, and I know that every time we've gone into our Tuesday morning conference that I'm surrounded by men and women whose view of proper governance and the role of government fit my own, and I appreciate them, and I don't want to just come across as, well, now he's on his way out, so he's being critical of the conference. It's just, it's because I love my country and because I love my conference and really the members on both sides that this is my best advice and judgment. And I thank you for the opportunity to share these kind of things to give to my colleagues, because it literally can't stay this way. There is a price, especially on the fiscal side of where we're headed, that I think the consequences, I think it's going to hit us harder and sooner than most people appreciate or understand.
Representative Scott Ridgel with us as he is wrapping up his final term in Congress. He's a Republican from the 2nd District in Virginia. You've talked about some friendships you've made. You've talked about people whose company you enjoy and some of the things you've enjoyed doing. What is it you're not going to miss?
Well, you know, we've been voting at some wacky hours here lately. It's hard to understand why that's done. But the immersion of it, Tim, is hard to kind of capture. And I haven't been very good at compartmentalizing the job. I kind of wake up, think about it.
You're a 24-hour congressman.
Well, I'd rather not be.
Right.
But when I'm home with my family, I wish I would have been a little more present. But there's something about the nature of the job. And I think where we are as a country right now, the range of issues that are facing our country, and I guess with my intense customer service mindset that I took into this office from my corporate background, you know, when you sit down next to somebody on the plane, you're talking about your country. And even when I had the privilege of FaceTiming my parents, 93 and 88 years old, every Sunday morning. And, well, that's a lot of times we're talking.
Every week you get together with your folks?
Well, on FaceTime.
Oh, on FaceTime, okay.
On FaceTime. This is what I tell people. I say, look.
The fact that they're that old and they're doing that, that's pretty cool.
I know. And so this is what I tell people, is that technology has allowed us to connect, but at the same time, I know it's allowed us to, it's been a causal factor that we've not been using them properly. It's actually made us more divided. We're better connected, yet more divided. There's a troubling irony in that.
Mm-hmm. You remind me of Inherit the Wind, which is a great movie. Spencer Tracy plays the part of what was, you know, Clarence Darrow in the Scopes monkey
right.
trial. But when he says, with technology, we have mastered the air with the airplane, but somehow the skies become befouled and the birds are less majestic. And the idea is that technology carries with it a lot of wonderful, but also some kind
yes.
of painful realities, too.
Yeah, and it's not inherently evil. And I'm a very proactive, I mean, our office, our staff, they're younger, of course, than me, generally. Yeah, they all are. And very much so. About half my age, actually.
Get used to it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But they get a kick out of it when I come in with a new app or I've discovered something. I love technology, so I'm not anti-technology. But, Tim, as I
usual see, response I get from one of those is that, oh, yeah, I got rid of that one about a year ago.
I'll tell you, I've got to be really up on things. But I get emails, for example, from people that are highly educated, people that I respect. I mean, solid Americans, and emails that are just so far off base, that are not based on fact, that are circulating within, in this case, the hard right community, For whether it's the false view of what congressional benefits are, benefits for life after one term, or a false view. I saw one thing that General Dunford, our chairman of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, it was presented in this email as if it was a letter written by him, just laying the president out saying that he had resigned. And this letter was forwarded to many people, and how many times it was forwarded after that. And it's they're clearly false. And so one of the things that I've been intent on and deliberate about in my service, and I think needs to be elevated in a much greater degree in this institution, is can we identify for a topic the facts? Can we at least agree upon the facts? As we go through this debate about what to do about the terror watch list and the selectee list and the no-fly list, Tim, the range of things that have been said about the number of people on this list, I gave you a number this morning that my bill deals with less than 3,000 Americans, right. Actually less than. Mm-hmm. Now, a gentleman wrote, I got a very nice editorial out of the Daily Press, that was one topic of, applauding my effort here. But then the next day or day after, a person came back and rebutted that. And the numbers cited on these lists were very different than the ones that I had. And I smiled because here we go again. If my number's not right, I'll change.
Is that deliberate falsehood, or is that people using apples to compare to oranges?
Well, it's apples and oranges. And I'm not in judgment of the gentleman who wrote that. Now, we may find at the end that we do disagree, but I'd rather find that we disagree after all the facts have been agreed to. And I've seen this with my own friends. Now, we were very careful about vetting the numbers upon which I made my decision to support, the Collins and Curbelo bill. But as I listen to my colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, these numbers are all over the map. And that, I think that leadership, one thing they could do, and I need to be more proactive in telling them this or suggesting it to them, is maybe in the Democratic and Republican leadership could at least get together and say, well, here are the facts that we at least agree on, mm-hmm. on this particular issue. And where we go from there on policy, we can maybe peel off. But it's hard to get the facts of a matter.
I wonder, and you mentioned before about your accompanying President Obama on Air Force One. Some people said, oh, this might not be a good thing for you. And there has been a lot of finger pointing about who's to blame for some of the disunity here in Washington, D.C. Let's, if I can for a moment, look at the presidential race, because we have two candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, both of whom have their own approach to what will take place. Hillary Clinton worked in the Senate. Donald Trump says, I'm an outsider. We need somebody from outside to change the way things are done here in Washington, D.C. Is either one of them on track for an answer there? Forget about policy, just about their approach.
Well, I'd say the general principle that someone coming in with a fresh approach, that appeals to me. Now, as we get down to the actual manifestation of our two alternatives, the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee, I am stunned and disappointed that these are the two individuals that are before us as in our choices. And I've been very clear on my views on this, and I wish I didn't have to come to this conclusion, but I've been very clear I cannot and won't support the Republican nominee. And under any circumstances could I support the Democratic nominee. So for the first time in my life, I'm going to end up, and I know what this means statistically, but to have a clear conscience for the first time in my life, I'll just have to write somebody in.
Now, so you can't support Donald Trump. What particularly do you find problematic?
The principal objection that I have it has to do with his role as commander-in-chief and seeing his what he said and how he goes about his decision making. And I think there's a recklessness about him. I remember him saying that we're going to take out the families of the terrorists as a deliberate part of American policy. Now, he might have backtracked on that, but it's the temperament. He's lacking the judgment, the temperament. I think there needs to be a soberness about a commander in chief and the seriousness. And I just don't see that in him. I think that his statements will commit either directly or indirectly the United States to actions that that I'm not sure he's fully capable of navigating once he's started them. And so it is the notion of putting a, well, on the House floor, it's putting a voting card in the slot, or if I'm voting locally in my own district, the act of voting in the affirmative, there is an association there of saying, I want this person elevated. And I just have a clear conscience. I can't be part of elevating him.
Because the Republican argument for some is, I have to vote for him as odious as he is because I have to keep Hillary Clinton from becoming president.
I understand that argument. And
but you don't buy it.
Well, this is a very personal decision. In fact, I don't bring it up. Well, you brought it up this morning. I was very clear about this prior to the Virginia primary. Now, in all full disclosure, he won Virginia too, so my view didn't mean all that much, and that's okay. But I had to be on record as to what I believe.
Well,
and
I think it's important for people to hear from somebody who is a member of the party that he's
I
representing,
believe that.
And you're in a and you're in a state that is going to play very heavily into the campaign. There's going to be a lot of campaign.
No question. That's my understanding. I think he's coming down there and giving a speech either today or tomorrow.
He is. And now you are, though, not saying that philosophically it's more of a temperament issue for you, or philosophically
well,
do you have issues?
It is
also?
No. Well, I mean, philosophically, if he's to the extent that he could be, he could define his views as a limited government. I think in that sense, less regulations, we're in agreement on that. We could have a chart, you know, a couple of columns, and I could say, here we go. Now, I will say, back to being a fiscal conservative, he's doing what everybody else tends to do when they're running for government. They're going to say, or running for president, they're going to lower taxes. We're going to lower taxes. Well, I can tell you right now, as a fiscal conservative, that is a reckless decision. And I've been through this. I've been through this at the highest levels. I mean, when I went through my rejection of the Americans for Tax Reform pledge on an empirical basis, and I've always said, I can say it here, I mean, I debate Grover Norquist on your show or anywhere else, and do it on an empirical basis. That there's been times when we as Republicans have voted for levels of spending that we are not matching on the revenue side. And to me, to have structural deficits, if everything you wanted implemented was implemented, that is not a fiscally conservative position. That's not consistent with our party principles and values. And I can defend that statement. I've done so.
Mm-hmm.
And I can show on a number line, you know, mathematically that, you know, our spending is going to be somewhere around 20% as Republicans.
Well, like emergency military spending. I mean, it seems to me that that would be the time when you would say we have to make an argument for raising tax because when we go to war in Iraq, we need to pay for more material and personnel.
This is what I didn't understand, you know, and I know I've been more critical of our Republican folks. I could take a whole nother show and go the other way. But when we were invading Iraq and we're listening intently to our commander-in-chief and our president, what should we do? Go shopping. I wasn't looking for that answer.
Mm-hmm.
The American people will respond. If they're given good information, hard facts, they'll make good decisions. They're willing to sacrifice for a noble cause. I think Republicans have absolutely contributed to our fiscal situation. Medicare Part D added no commensurate increase in revenue. The two wars, no commensurate tax increase. And at the same time, our Democratic friends, their categorical refusal, at least in any practical way, to reform mandatory spending, this has done the nation a huge disservice. And if you grab that third rail of politics and say, let's thoughtfully reform mandatory spending, they'll come on you. The Democratic machine will come on you like killer bees. But we have to have men and women who run for office who can withstand that and push back on that.
On Hillary Clinton specifically, philosophically, I know you're different from where she is, but I wanted to get to that point of whether or not she could do a better job than, say, Donald Trump. And temperamentally, it sounds like you don't think he's able to bring people together. Whether she could do a better job. I mean, she did have to work across the aisle as a senator. Obviously, Secretary of State, there tends to be some diplomacy in there, although you're working with foreign leaders as opposed to people at home. Is that something that holds any hope? Would the Congress work better under a Clinton presidency than under the Obama presidency?
I don't think so, but I don't think it could be any worse than it is now. I think there's been this irony, and it's been an unfortunate one, that a person who communicates so well, the president, has not engaged Congress, I think, on the more rank and file basis. I had a Democratic friend who said, Scott, we're not even going over to the White House. I mean, we're not on a regular basis engaging each other. And I think that you look back to Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson did that on a regular basis. And I know the times are different, but the principle is valid.
Well, Lyndon Johnson's the perfect example that people have pointed to as somebody who was a former leader in the Senate. So he tended to grab people and, you know, call them up or intimidate them or do whatever he needed to do.
A little bit of both.
Yeah.
And they had more of a, they could get that earmark thing. I think that was a very powerful tool. That's not in place right now. But I think Hillary Clinton is not qualified for first, I think, on the character issue. I know it's out there, but I do hold the view that she cannot be trusted. I think the evidence is very clear there. And then the second part is her view toward government. Virtually everything that she's saying represents an expansion of a government that is truly already too big. And look, I've said that public service is a series of imperfect alternatives, you know, voting on bills, almost every bill coming at you. I've got to either hit green, red, and I look at a bill, and very, very seldom is that bill just what I want.
Right.
But never has this idea of a continuous stream of imperfect alternatives come to such a head as the one that we have now with the two presidential candidates.
And as a matter of fact, these bills are not often a compromise between A and B. In other words, it's not like the difference between 10 and 0 and let's come up with 5. It's like, you give me this and I'll give you this. You hate this, I hate this, but we'll come together and we'll both be unhappy about it, and therefore we've got a compromise.
Very little of that. But I think, Tim, I am transitioning out of public service, my fighting for our country is not going to stop. And I've been thinking about this because I think every citizen needs to kind of maybe revisit what our own responsibility is here, because apathy is calling on each one of us. It's like anesthesia. It's a seductive call to say, to kind of check out, to say the problems are too great. But that environment is the breeding ground, for kind of a dictatorship type of, a totalitarian type of government. It's toxic to a republic. And so I'm very deliberate now about, and once I move out of office, of helping our country, and I'm not exactly sure what this is going to look like, but to reject apathy, to choose to engage and be constructively disruptive and changing our country. We don't have to live like this with redistricting. We can do better. It'll always be a challenge, but we can do better. We can use our mobile devices better. And I think 20, 25 years from now, the experts are going to look back and look at the studies and say, this technology came on us so quick that we didn't quite handle it as we should. I think it's going to have some health impacts on us and other things.
Speaking of your constituents and your district, what is it you think is going to make the difference between voting R or D in this election? What's the big issue for most people right now that you serve?
That I serve in Virginia too?
Yeah.
That I think the difference will be first a sense of who can speak with clarity for our men and women in uniform.
Because mm-hmm. That's a big military district, I know.
It is. Yeah. It is. But I love Virginia, too. It's southeast corner of Virginia, entrance to the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia Beach, Eastern Shore, Norfolk, and parts on the peninsula, Hampton and Newport News, and the little island of Tangier in the middle right there of the Chesapeake Bay. And I think they're going to look for someone who is going to put the country ahead of what's best for our party. And with that test out there that I just described, they've got a very difficult decision. All of us do.
Is there any one in particular you are going to miss not seeing on a regular basis?
Reed Ribble.
Ribble and Ridgel. It's like a law firm,
isn't
it?
Listen, our paths are crossed so many different ways. He's a wonderful...
Do the people confuse you?
Oh, listen, on the day that we took the oath of office, mm-hmm. my name's difficult to pronounce. It's Ridgel, and it's pronounced many different ways. Well, Reed didn't hear... I didn't know Reed, but he didn't hear his name called. And so on live on C-SPAN, you could just, you know, all my family's watching, my wife's up in the gallery, on and on. And so the clerk calls out Ribble, no answer, calls out Ribble again, no answer. And I'm thinking, well, maybe she mispronounced my name. And so I was almost ready to say Boehner, you know, when we were voting for speaker. And he did answer, but our paths have crossed so many ways. He came in like me, never served in public office, mm-hmm. and coincidentally, and independent of anything I'm doing, he also is taking the off-ramp. But I just enjoy him, and my wife Terry and his wife Dean are good friends.
Did you spend a lot of time in Washington on weekends? In other words, one of the things that people say is that these congressmen, they go home every weekend. They don't even socialize across party lines anymore.
Well, if I could get the class of freshmen that are coming in, Democrats and Republicans, first thing I'd say is be careful with your calendar, especially that first year. Guard it.
Don't overfill it.
Overfill it. It can really get to you. And when we started staying in Washington one weekend a month, we were deliberate about that. So when we're at a session on a Friday and in on a Monday, it just made sense to stay here. And that's been helpful. You see other members. And I think it also gives a chance for the member to decompress a little bit. So I didn't do that until about the last year and a half here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was always going home.
And you can drive, too, for you.
I can, but it just became... I got stuck in a few
traffic jams.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And so my wife.
A lot of people like going that way on the weekends, especially.
That little 30-minute flight has been better. And more often than not, it's on time. And that's how I go back. And I get to chat with some people at the airport.
Last question. Are you going to miss the fundraising?
Oh, that was the worst. It really was for me. I will not miss that at all. And
Does it take a lot of time?
Yes. Not at all. Like there was some 60-minute special, and that was way overblown in my view. I'm in a competitive district. I had to raise around $250,000 a quarter. Now, think about it. It's $1 million a year. Now, if we were on a church building project or United Way, doesn't matter, any type of nonprofit, and you said, hey, Scott, we got to raise $1 million this year, I'd say, okay, now we need a lead gift. Somebody, you know, in the community give us maybe $300,000-$400,000 as our lead gift, and we're going to get some other, you know, $100,000. Oh, no. Maximum is $2,700 per person, 54, you know, both cycles. Okay, 54. Okay, well, let's put together a committee and let's do all this. Well, you can have a committee, but if you don't get on the phone, individually, personally, you're not going to get, you know, $10,800 from a couple or $5,400 from an individual. You've got to do that. And so that was tough because as much as you enjoy, you know, connecting with people, oftentimes people want to talk to you about your country, and I'm happy to have done so. But let me put it this way, Tim. The succinct answer is when I right-clicked and hit delete on, and it said fundraising week, that was wonderful. I had right click delete, and that week just opened up, and it was nice.
We'll let you carry that happy thought with you as we wrap this up today. Representative Scott Ridgell's been our guest. I really appreciate you being in the studio with us. We were here at the beginning and not quite the end yet, but obviously an opportunity to sort of catch you on the bookends of this career.
Tim, this is not patronizing to say that I think we need more shows like this where people can get, I think, a sense of unvarnished and without a hard bias, and if one of your guests goes off on a hard bias, you're always pretty good about bringing them to the middle. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it, and I didn't have to bring you anywhere on this conversation.
Go.
Representative Scott Ridgell represents the 2nd Congressional District in Virginia, our special guest for this special hour here on POTUS, Sirius XM 124.